too directly. We're going to talk a little bit first to get started about love languages. And the reason we're going to do that is that people have different ways of receiving and expressing love in their lives, the way they do different actions and whatnot. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about how to, or get everyone thinking a little bit about how to show your spouse that you love them in ways that not only maybe resonate in your own heart, but actually understanding what resonates in their heart. So we're going to talk a little bit through love language, and we're going to talk, the idea is kind of building up that currency. And, you know, the idea is that, you know, I've done my best to treat Janelle as well as I can for 23 years now, right? And because of that faithfulness, if I make, you know, a stupid mistake, it's a lot easier for her to give me a little bit of grace than if I had been, you know, a jerk to her for the last 23 years, right? So just in that idea of understanding how to relate to our spouses so that the relationship is easy and it's easy to extend the benefit of the doubt to one another. And that's what love languages are a little bit about. Yeah, I went way off the notes already.
I'm like, so, I have no idea where he's going. But yeah. I'm just going to jump in here. So some of you are familiar with love languages. You've read the book maybe even. Some people, this is a new concept, and, you know, love languages is how your mate wants to be loved. What makes the greatest impression on them?
Yeah, what says I love you to them, right?
For example, your wife might feel more loved by you coming home and maybe taking the kids off her hands rather than bringing home a bouquet of flowers. And wives, your husband might feel more loved by a word of respect, you know, rather than adding something to the honey-do list. If you know what makes your spouse feel loved, it has great power. And a man who values respect, you know, he'll not really be able to take it if you mock him. And a wife who longs for communication hates the silent treatment, right? There's a little bit of give and take. Sometimes Greg will come home and he's tired, he's had a tough day, and I'll just let him talk, let him get it off his chest. And there's days he comes home and I've had a rough day and I need him just to be quiet and let me tell him what's going on. So there's some give and take.
Yeah, we want to talk a little bit and try to learn or help everybody learn what kind of actions speak love to the other person. And it's important because what you find out is that sometimes you're trying to do things for your spouse to tell them that you love them, but it doesn't register with them. It's not on their radar as an actual loving action. you know, so like as a good example, I remember, you know, one day I came home from work and I got to put my notes down so I can show you. But so I come home, I'm like, Janelle, how you doing? She goes, my entire day has been like this. Right, you know? And I said, yeah, that's great. Could you make me a sandwich? No. So understanding for her that at that point in time, being able to say, you know what, I got the kids, go, right? You know, right? You know that speaks way more to her than flowers or, you know, or anything else, right? So it's kind of trying to learn those things to talk a little bit about the things that uniquely express love to your spouse, because we all kind of have this filter. What seems to be a thoughtful expression to you, it might not resonate so much with your spouse. So we're going to talk about Gary Smalley. He wrote this book called The Five Love Languages. And he gives you kind of five general categories, which are quality time, words of affirmation, acts of service, physical touch. And the idea is that, you know, if your spouse's primary language or primary love language is like words of affirmation, then when you speak words of praise and appreciation to them, it's like rain on a, you know, in a desert. But if there's someone who, say, is their primary love language is more acts of service, then that's the kind of person where actions speak louder than words. And so you have to be aware of that.
Some people's love language is gift giving or gift receiving. And so if you're someone that fills love by giving gifts and your spouse knows that, that is much more valuable bringing a gift, say, not even necessarily on your birthday or Christmas, but on a non-occasion. Just to get something that's meaningful can be such a great expression of love rather than an act of service or rather than even taking the kids off your hand, though I can't even believe that. So,
yeah, and you know, and the gift giving thing, it doesn't have to be expensive stuff. A lot of times, it's a card or those kind of things that just express that you're thinking of them.
And if you're married to one of those, I can tell you right now, it's if you're thinking, what do they want? What would they like? And not just, well, this is pretty nice here. You know, think about their needs. That means more than anything. I'm not the gift giver. Yeah. I do know that.
So, another thing is like if your spouse's language is quality time. You know, I know that that's Janelle's love language is quality time. Just spending time together. But the trick is you got to figure out a way to cut the distractions. You know, it's turn off the TV or if you take her out to dinner. Husbands, you need to sit so you're not facing the ball game. Right?
Quantity isn't necessarily quality.
And actually continued eye contact throughout the whole dinner. Right? So quality time, physical touch is the other one. Holding hands, walking arms in arms, or arm in arm. I think it's an important one because if you look back, especially those of you who have babies right now, you know, we pick babies up, we cuddle them, we hold on to them. And, you know, a baby knows it's love before it ever can even understand the concept of love. And obviously it's physical touch that does that for an infant. So physical touch can be very powerful. And in marriage, you know, the love language of physical touch, it can be, something as simple as just walking hand in hand or walking arm in arm with one another, all the way down to, you know, to kissing and embracing and intercourse. So physical touch has a wide range of things.
So I think we're going to put the 5 different love languages up here.
Yeah, let me get around to that here.
And while he's doing that, if you want more information about these, because we're not going to go much deeper into this, you can go to the website he's going to put up there too in a minute.
I didn't put the website up. I'll have to give it to you later on.
Yeah. All right, let me give you the website. It's the Focus on the Family. It's 5, the number 5.
Yeah, let's just do it later.
Lovelanguages.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want it, we can email it out to everybody. So,
all right, so do we even need to talk through those? Because they're right there.
Well, so we're not, but what I wanted everybody to do, so you got your quiz.
Okay, yeah, you got your quiz. So what you're going to do is you're going to figure out what you are, right, by looking here what you have the most of. Is that how it ended, mm-hmm. Greg? But don't tell your spouse. Figure out what you are without telling your spouse.
And then your spouse has to try to guess.
And you want to put it like first, second, third, fourth, fifth. What is your does it work that way?
Yeah, the highest number means it's your primary love language. So, for instance, you can see up here if you have a whole bunch of accounts in words of affirmation, then that means that's your primary love language.
Yeah, ties.
Okay.
Well
so that means
good.
That you're conflicted and you need to have counseling. No.
So figure that out without letting your spouse know.
Right.
Take like 30 seconds. Get it figured out.
So take a few minutes, see what your language is, see if your spouse knows or has an idea of what your primary one is.
Yeah, once you have your figured out, then I want you guys to talk and see if you can guess what your spouse's primary love language is.
Yeah, and it's been small up here, so if you need to come up and look at it, you can do that. We'll come back in a minute. Oh, it's in the book. Okay.
Oh, awesome.
Awesome.
Thank you.
So you ready to go? Let's go.
So how are we doing, guys?
So how's everybody doing?
Have you guys figured it out?
Okay.
They're not even aware we're talking. How's it going? Have you guys figured it out? So were there any surprises?
No.
No? Did you feel like most people knew? You knew your spouse's love language, or was there like, oh?
So raise your hand if you kind of knew your spouse's primary love language.
Nice.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. Good.
How about second and third?
I saw a couple of guys high-fiving one another across the table. I think finally you got one right.
It might even have surprised yourself.
Was there anybody that was like a, like your spouse was kind of a close second on one that you didn't quite
Someone
see?
Someone said some
right?
ties in here.
So to correct my first error, by the way, it's Gary Chapman, not Gary Smalley. Okay.
Yes.
And the second thing is I didn't realize I had put it in the prayer book, the
You'll
website.
You'll see it this week.
So it's actually, I've
Page 32
it's in the
has
book.
The website for the five love languages. So
right.
You already have it.
And the thing I would tell you is, you know, the book is, the book's a pretty good book. I haven't read the whole thing. But you don't have to spend, too much time on it from the standpoint of, it's nice to have something that kind of helps you categorize how to relate to your spouse, but you know no one is solely one area and one thing. We're all a mix of all these things, but it's nice just to kind of have some categories to think about when you're trying to. It's just nice to have those categories to think about. I won't go on about it much further.
Well, it's good to talk about it because there may be some areas and you know, some conflicts going on at home, and it's because you've forgotten or haven't considered expressing or ministering to that love language. You know, especially over the years, you've kind of just gotten too familiar and you come home and you forget that's your spouse's primary love language. So it might be good to have a little bit of a refresher.
Yeah, knowing what those things are that really resonate in your spouse's heart is important. There's one of the old Puritan pastors that I like to read from. He makes a really interesting analogy. And he makes this analogy about how the devil works sin in our heart, but it's a great analogy for anything. And what he talks about if you go and you find a grand piano, okay, one that has a top open and all that, you actually can if you stick your head in and you begin to hum a note, if you hum the right note, what will happen is the strings in the piano will begin to sympathetically vibrate with the note that you're humming, right? And so the idea is that, you know, there's notes in your spouse's heart, right? They're like the piano. And there's certain things that resonate in their heart, and there's certain things that don't resonate in their heart. And the idea is kind of having this awareness of the things that really do resonate in your spouse's heart, that really speak love to them. So that's kind of the idea behind all this. Showing that you love your spouse is far more than saying I love you. And it's not enough to give love in the way that you're accustomed to giving it. You want to learn how to give it in the way that speaks or resonates with their heart the most effectively. The video now.
It's time for a sex video. You thought you could say that in church? Sorry, Pastor.
Oops. Oh, I totally messed everything up here. Hold on. Sorry. Okay. I think I might have it right now.
Sex. Throughout the Bible, it's proclaimed as a good thing. A profound expression of love that forges a unique and powerful bond between a man and a woman. But along the way, something went seriously wrong. When humanity left their perfect and life-giving relationship with God, sin entered the scene and infected everything. Sin caused people to become disconnected from God, from each other, and from themselves. Sex, the ultimate connection between men and women, couldn't hide for long. Sin grabbed hold of sex and transformed it into something completely unrecognizable. This new form of sex had nothing to do with respect or commitment, and everything to do with lust and control. It was no longer about two people becoming one. Sex became about the desires of the individual, a way for people to get what they want from one another. To put it plainly, sex became a transaction. And so, sex strayed further and further away from God's original plan. Fast forward to today, and sex is everywhere. People are obsessed with it. Sex, which used to be a good thing, became an ultimate thing. Something that validates one's very existence and a reason for living. And with its new and elevated status came many promises. Promises it couldn't deliver, leaving an entire society feeling empty and disillusioned. But like any addiction, the answer is always more. More relationships, more romance, and of course, more sex. And it's in this endless search that we find ourselves. Sex is clearly broken, but it isn't the real problem. It's simply the crack on the surface. The real problem of sin goes much deeper, and its consequences are far more devastating. Here's the good news, though. There's still hope. God can redeem you and your sexuality. Sex can be a good thing again.
So I found that little video. I thought it was a great way to kind of encapsulate everything we're going to talk about tonight, right? Redeeming what a sinful creation has taken from us. Now, this subject, it's perhaps the most difficult one in marriage. Our desire for the other person is influenced by the quality of our marriage relationship, by our physical health, by our feelings about our own bodies. You add to those things the stress of your job or your school. You add kids. You add the busyness of your daily life. And, you know, they can rob you of your energy. And the complexity factor behind something as intimate as this can really get can go off the chart pretty quick. Understanding the complexity, I want to attempt tonight to kind of bring us back to a biblical view of intimacy, a view that will kind of help us transcend all the things that kind of rob us of a fulfilling and a healthy intimate life with our spouses. Because when we begin to see what Scripture and what the Lord really meant behind a husband and a wife becoming one, there's something very deep, very profound, and very powerful there. And if we can kind of reconnect ourselves with it, I believe that the Lord can do some phenomenal things. So I want us to understand what God really intended for this area. So in the beginning, though, to understand the biblical view, I want to take a short look at some of the kind of common secular views. And the reason I want to do this is that, you know, we are all so inundated with the secular view of sex. And, you know, depending on what your intimate life was like before you got married, there may be some things that you really have to deal with. There may be some scars from your past. There may be some attitudes and beliefs about an intimate life with your spouse that really prevent you from having the powerful effect that the Lord wants it to have now. So we want to look at some of these things and kind of try to dispel how the secular views may have influenced you. We're going to look at three major secular views. The first one is that sex is just an appetite like any other normal appetite. The second view is it's part of our lower nature, or sex is dirty, okay? Or the third view is that it's a critical form of expression for individual fulfillment, okay? Now, under the first one, it's a normal appetite. It's a pretty common in the secular culture, and the idea is that, look, sexuality is just another human function. We need to eat, we need to breathe, we need to have sex. And, you know, if we look at this just a little bit, I think our experience with attraction and desire, this view doesn't really hold water very well. I mean, if you look around, it's clear that the culture recognizes that there's inherent power in our sexuality. You know, we don't use any other normal bodily function to sell cars or clothes or, you know, or anything else, right? But for some reason, the advertisers have figured out that that they can sell cars and all kinds of things with human sexuality. You know, I mean, in a sense, it seems kind of crazy that you would buy a car because there's, you know, some really good-looking model standing next to it. But, you know, human nature, we tend to do those things. If you discuss this subject with a secular person, I think you can address it in one. You can kind of address this this area very easily, because you can just ask him to say, if you really believe that this is a normal bodily function, then why do you think about it constantly? Okay, there aren't many other bodily functions that we think about constantly like we do this. Now, we're going to talk through this a little bit in more detail later. But the natural function view, it is a low view of intimacy. It says there's nothing special and we ought to just follow our instincts when they assert themselves. I think it was interesting, and as I'm doing my research, I ran across this article when Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez got married. They signed a prenuptial agreement where they agreed that they had to have sex 4 times a week. the fact that you would put that in a prenuptial agreement, first of all, is kind of interesting. But it is not just a normal function. And we have to be careful, because, you can go to bed with your spouse because you believe you're just supposed to. It's kind of part of marriage, right? It's a normal function. It's perfunctory. But you don't necessarily have any desire or any expectation that something spiritual is going to happen. So we want to kind of, I want you to think about that a little bit. And if you're having that, one area where I've heard this is, I've heard older women advise younger women, especially like when they're newly married. They say, sometimes you just have to do it even if you don't want to, right? And though I appreciate the sentiment behind that, okay, it throws our sexuality into the category of being perfunctory.
Well, that kind of leads right into the second one of the lower, it's viewed as a lower nature or a necessary evil. And some of you may not even be able to identify with this, but some of you will. The second view in our culture is that sex is part of our lower nature, a necessary evil required for the continued existence of humanity. The thinking might go something like, well, I don't really like it, but, I need to do this because I want to have a family, so, let's just get going. Some approach it as a marital duty, something I have to do because I feel obligated. And there's reasons why people feel this way. Some people approach intimacy from a worldview with high expectation. They go in, oh, it's going to be this and this and this, and maybe over time your expectation hasn't been met. And so now you're just in the, well, let's just have to do our duty thing. Others, maybe you're coming from a place where you've experienced abuses in the past. Maybe things were associated with power or control. Your intimacy was about manipulation, and that can turn it to be undesirable and make sex something that is stained and not something that you're excited about. That manipulation is devastating to intimacy. There's this play, it's called Lysistrata. Am I saying that right? Lysistrata. And it was written 400 BC, and it's a comic play, and it's about a woman's mission to end the Peloponnesian War. And she persuades in the play all the women of Greece to withhold sex from their spouses or their lovers until they promised to go and make a peace treaty to end the war. And apparently it didn't work well. There was just more friction between the sexes than the war getting taken care of. But it was a good play.
Yeah, it was kind of a funny play, and it kind of highlights the battle between the sexes a little bit. It's a funny example, but we know and we see countless abuses of sexuality on a daily basis. Okay, they range from the somewhat socially acceptable players, right? Boys will be boys kind of thing, to pornography, to outright rape. We hear a lot in the news about rape, about date rape, about all kinds of things. This area has been tremendously abused, and I don't want to dwell on it, other than to say all these things that happen, they add pressure to the view that sex is dirty, right? Because if sex is manipulative, if it's a power struggle, if any of those kind of things, what does that mean? It means it's demeaning to one side of it, right? And if it's demeaning, then it falls into the dirty category.
It becomes just a duty that you have to fulfill if you're in a relationship like that. You know, God has intended to have a connection. He's intended to have healing. And when you are using it as a way of manipulating sex, using it as a manipulation tool, you're missing all of that. Hebrews 13:4 says, "The marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled." And when you bring any of that into the bedroom, it's defiled.
Yeah, and you know, in that scripture, what it tells us is that when we have intimacy with our spouses, and it's in covenant relationship, and things are right, that is, it can't be dirty because the marriage bed is undefiled. The last view, sensual fulfillment. The idea that sex is just a kind of a bodily function or a normal function is kind of leads to this view of sensual fulfillment. And the idea is that, you know, sex is only a form. It's only a form of self-expression, the giving or the receiving of pleasure. And this view is everywhere. The media portrays great lovers as someone who has the ability to give a physical thrill. In this view, sex is reduced to experience and technique. You often hear this. I don't know if I've heard this a lot. Maybe you haven't. But you'll hear people say when the relationship is getting serious that they should sleep together in order to with their boyfriend and their girlfriend to make sure that they're sexually compatible in bed, right? That's this thinking of sex being performance-based lines up with that. But this view about it being a fulfillment issue, it is inherently selfish. Because what it does, I mean, at its base level, what it does is it compares the past experience of intimacy with your current experience. It judges how well you did. Who wants to be judged in bed? I mean, how can you have intimacy if you think you're being judged or you're judging? The most intimate thing the Lord's desired, and yet we can ruin it with that. Now, we're going to dive into the scriptures because it has some things to say about this. And suffice it to say that the three views that we've talked about, these secular worldly views, are what we call low views of Scripture. But Scripture holds a high view. Scripture knows the power and the purpose of intimacy, and that is why the Bible, it celebrates sensuality between a husband and a wife, but it also restricts it to covenant due to its power.
So let's look at the biblical reasons for sex. Of course, and these aren't in any specific order, but of course, procreation is in the list, right? Psalm 127 says, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. The Lord commanded Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." So we know children are part of the reason for sex. The next one, pleasure. Song of Solomon 4:9 says, "You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. How far is your love, my sister, my spouse?
Fair.
How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfumes than all spices. Your lips, O my spouse, drip at the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon." That makes you hot under the collar. And then Proverbs 5:18 says, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured," I love that word, "with her love." So the Bible unashamedly celebrates sensuality between a husband and a wife. A quick read through Song of Solomon, we love that. It's clear that God is not prudish about sex. He didn't close his eyes when Adam and Eve were in the garden.
Yeah, it's not like God looked away and he turned back and said, "What are you doing?"
Though the Bible restricts the context of sex to marriage, it unashamedly celebrates sex between a husband and a wife and finds nothing dirty or even normal about it. It is, and we'll explain that a little more. It is clear from these scriptures that the Bible celebrates deep emotion and passion.
Yeah. Now, if you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 15. We're going to spend a little bit of time. In the end, what we're going to see is that, we'll see it as we get to it. Let's read it. Everybody got it? 1 Corinthians 6, 15 is the verse.
If we say a reference it too fast, just raise your hand if you need it again.
Slow down. Okay, here we go. So do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? The two, he says, shall become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. Now, Paul gives us some really good understanding here of what happens when a husband and wife come together in an intimate union. You have to look at the words a little bit, though. So in verse 15, when he uses the word body, the Greek word is soma, and it speaks of the physical body. And it can be used either to speak of a human body or an animal body, just any physical body, okay? But in verse 16, when he says the two shall become one flesh, he uses the Greek term sarx, which speaks not only of the body, but of the emotions, the will, and the whole person. So, though the two words are translated body, they don't necessarily mean the same thing. Matter of fact, if they kind of did, the passage, it wouldn't make much sense, because Paul would just be saying, don't you know that when you become one body with someone, you become one body? I mean, you know, what would be the point of that, right? What Paul's thought is that he's telling us is that when you become one body with someone, you become one person with someone. So Paul's thought is that it's wrong to have sex outside of marriage with a prostitute, because every sex act is meant to be a uniting act. Okay? It is radically dissonant to give your body to a person to whom you will not also commit your life, because there's nothing deeper than pleasure going on. Paul is saying is that there's a spiritual union happening, and in the process of two people becoming one flesh, they become one person. He's saying that sex is a uniting act. I think this is interesting, because if you consider this, when Janelle and I were dating, that whole process is getting to know one another. So there's, you know, lots of nights talking, there's going to the beach, there's spending time, going out to dinner, all those things, all those that you do, right? But there's something that happens in the intimate union between a husband and wife that can happen in no other way. Okay, you can't relate yourself into the kind of union that God meant to happen in the intimate act between a husband and a wife. There's tremendous power in it. So you see, when we add 1 Corinthians' explanation to God's benediction of marriage in Genesis 2, where he says a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they will become one flesh, we kind of begin to understand now what's going on, and that God is saying that physically knowing another person in the context of a lifetime covenant commitment, it creates one person. Now, Genesis 2:25, it also says that, and they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. This understanding of this is that it's both literal and figurative. Literally naked, unclothed, but figurative, meaning that they were completely vulnerable to one another in every way. Nothing was hidden, nothing was held back. And so what's going on is the Bible is saying that sex is a uniting act. It takes two people and it makes one of them. And that's why the prohibitions in the Bible are there, because it's only healthy to become physically naked and vulnerable with someone if you're willing to become vulnerable with them in every way. So ultimately, sex is a way of confirming the vulnerability and maintaining the deep union that God means for you to have. Now, we're going to talk a little bit more about it, but I want to make a point here that because sex is so powerful, it is also very sensitive. Okay, your intimacy, it is a reflection of your heart, your relationship. It's a reflection of the seasons of life that you're in. And, you know, a strong, intimate life, it takes a great awareness of the intricate interplay between relationship and time and circumstances and all those things. Now, the Bible does not command abstinence outside of marriage because it has a low view of sex. Okay? It commands it because it has such a high view of sex. And this helps us make sense of this now because sex is powerful. And like anything else that's powerful, it can cause tremendous good, or if used incorrectly, it can cause tremendous damage. Tremendous damage. It is perhaps the most powerful God-created way for you to give your entire self to another. It's God's appointed way for two people to say, I belong permanently, completely, and exclusive to you. And that's why covenant is necessary.
Were you going to put that one up there?
I don't know if I was. No, I wasn't.
Okay. I like that. It's perhaps the most powerful God-created way for you to give your entire self to another. It is God's appointed way for two people to say, I belong permanently, completely, and exclusively to you. That is why covenant is necessary. In Genesis 2, 24 and 25, when he talks about naked and not ashamed, it's a total, complete knowledge and total, complete acceptance of one another. There's a tremendous power. I think we keep saying that word, tremendous power. I like that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll get it at some point.
There's a tremendous power here. All that two people can do to know each other cannot be accomplished. Can't accomplish it. Let me say that
again. Other way. There you go.
No other way, yeah. In the sexual union in marriage brings an intimacy that can't be accomplished in any other way. John White.
Yeah.
Who is that, by the way?
He's a Christian counselor.
He's a Christian counselor. I've been reading this quote. I'm like, I don't know who this guy is, but it's a great quote. Listen up. It says, immediate erotic thrill is the most superficial thrill of the sex act. The body exposure that arouses and accompanies the sex act can be profoundly symbolic and powerfully healing. It is healing if it is the concrete expression of what is happening in the whole relationship. The uncovering of my inner self, the uncovering of my deepest fears and yearnings. If I do that as I tenderly look upon the body of another and as I experience what it is to feel the tenderness of another's caress, then the one who accepts and caresses my body with tenderness also accepts and caresses my inmost being, or so it seems when all is right. So it only makes sense that sexual relations be confined to marriage for mutual disclosure and tender acceptance is not the activity of a moment, but the delicate fabric of a lifetime's weaving. Each time sex springs from casual encounter, physical disclosure and touching, without personal disclosure and touching, some of its life-giving and healing nature is destroyed.
It's a long quote, but what he's saying is that when someone touches and caresses the physical body, and it's accompanied by a mutual personal disclosure and acceptance of everything about that person, then there's enormous power for completing and healing. And so there's this cyclical process where physical vulnerability and relational vulnerability complement one another to lead to a greater expression of both. So we understand intimacy is an expression of covenant. It's I'm all in. It must begin. Sorry, I locked my notes here. So when we understand that intimacy is an expression of covenant, you know, we talked about covenant being I'm all in, right? No matter what. Then what happens is this understanding has to banish our wrong secular ideas, right? You know, the guy who wants to do it no matter where the relationship is at, okay, or the girl who just puts up with it because she married him or it's what you have to do in order to keep your man interested kind of thing. This idea of God creating a greater, deeper, closer union between you and your spouse. And it all being, you know, the one who caresses me physically is the one who caresses my soul, means that we have to begin to banish these secular ideas of intimacy. When thought in light of covenant, both sides will always be asking, how is our covenant relationship and is it supporting intimacy? But then also saying, I will give myself not as duty, but as an expression of covenant.
Video.
Okay, video. We need to lighten it up a little bit, I think. Oop, sorry.
I am a man, and I am romantically challenged. My wife is from Venus, and I am from Mars. But we must learn to live together on Earth. Although I don't like to talk or share my feelings, I am here tonight to do both, because I love my wife.
Who's up?
Hi, my name is Dan, and I am romantically challenged.
Hi, Dan.
Dan, I want you to share your feelings, even though it goes against everything you stand for as a man.
I tried the trick that Jerry taught us last week.
A trick is what a two-bit magician does at a county fair. Jerry was given a technique, and a technique...
Hey, Dr. Phil, let him finish.
So anyway, I decided I'd use Jerry's technique last week. My wife came to me all exasperated and pulled her hair out and whatnot about her job. And I used Jerry's words exactly. I said, now honey, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to listen or fix it? And what'd she say?
Listen.
Fix it.
And so anyway, I tried to listen. I really did. But in the middle of listening, I came up with a 7-point plan to fix it. I'm so ashamed.
It's okay, Dan. Hey, you're multitasking, all right? And that is very hard for your untrained one-track man brain to do. Feel proud of that, all right? Who's next?
Heck, I'll go. Hey guys, I'm Jerry, and I'm a, or was, romantically challenged.
Hey Jerry.
Hey. Yeah, I actually went through the program, and now I'm a real romantic, according to someone at home.
All right. Okay, Jerry.
Remember when we talked about how we're supposed to love our wives like Christ loves the church? Well, gentlemen, mission accomplished. Okay? This weekend, I saw some extra charges on Cindy's bank card. So, yeah. But I, you know, instead of yelling and screaming like I normally would, I acted in a more Christ-like manner.
Yeah.
So I simply turned over her nightstand and her scrapbooking table and said, get out of here, money changer.
I don't think that's what the Ephesians 5 passage means.
Okay, I'm sorry, Bill Gates. Who are you?
No, I think when it says that we should love our wives like Christ loved the church, that means that we're supposed to serve and sacrifice.
Hey, I was cleansing the temple. I was cleansing the temple.
Okay, different perspective, not necessarily right, just different. All right, I think the question is, how many of you have ever done anything for your wife without desiring anything in return? Maybe sitting on the couch, cuddling up to her, watching a movie, maybe The Notebook.
Are you even married?
Jesus wasn't married. Now look, the point I'm trying to... No, I'm not, and that stings a little bit. I have read a lot, well, parts of a lot of relationship books, and if anyone thinks they can lead this group better than I can, put your hand down, Jerry. I am sharing my feelings. And that's what you need to do with your wives. Practice makes perfect. Who wants to go next?
I guess I could give it a shot. Hi, guys. My name is Sheldon, and I am romantically challenged.
Hi, Sheldon.
I thought I'd just share a few things from the program that I've learned so far. First, if your wife says she doesn't know where she wants to go eat, well, that's pretty much code for Italian and expensive Italian. And secondly, if you're getting her an anniversary gift, the Snuggies, not really a very good idea, even if it's the leopard print. Learn that one the hard way. And then third, the simple act of doing dishes is a big, big win. I mean, a big one. So do all the dishes you can. Thanks.
I have no idea what you said, but that was good. Bathroom break isn't yet.
Sorry, I gotta go. Sorry, guys.
Oh, Mr. Big Guy doesn't want to share, does he?
Not tonight.
Probably doesn't care about his wife.
Okay, I'll share. Okay. This is a picture of my wife and kids. I've been married for 20 years. We married young, and I don't regret it. Have we had our share of storms? Sure. Do we have some amazing memories? Too many to mention. Do I try to fix things? I do. But it's just because after 20 years of marriage, I still want to ride in and be my wife's knight in shining armor. I remember when we got engaged, her father looked at me and he said, "Just love her the way Christ loved the church." I smiled and said I would, having no idea what that meant. And I still don't know if I understand it. But you know what I want? I want to be a man who wakes up every morning and asks the question, how can I bless my wife? And God, men, isn't that what you want? I mean, isn't your wife worth it?
Hey, wait. Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Sit down, Jerry.
Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Okay, enough. Sit down. What is going on? Sit down. Please, sit down.
I need a wife.
So hopefully you enjoyed that.
Amen. I like that one. I need a wife. Okay. So naked and not ashamed means vulnerable and accepted. It also means hiding nothing, no ulterior motives. This is where sex that is manipulative really is a problem. We talked about that before because it's the wrong motive. This is why relationship is so important. Remember our quote, the person who accepts and caresses me physically is the person who accepts and caresses me completely. The only way to get to the belief of complete acceptance is a lifetime of displayed trustworthiness. And the way you've treated and are treating your spouse directly affects us. You know, how can they become united with you if you aren't trustworthy? And I don't mean just trustworthy, like I'm not going to go out on you. I mean trustworthy with your emotions, with their fears, with their hopes, with what they feel, what they care about, with their dreams. It's the whole package.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be very direct, so much of what happens in the bedroom is related to what's happening in your relationship. And so, you know, we're hitting relationship very hard right now because they're so intertwined with one another. And there's kind of an old rule. It's you know, in the Southern vernacular, it's one oops equals 100 attaboys, right? And it reminds us of the fact that it only takes one mistake can wipe out an awful lot of trust building. And so you really do have to be careful because it's easy to kind of wipe things off, you know, wipe your relationship out, and then you don't understand why your intimate life really is not working the way you'd like it to.
If you're newly married, you don't have that history of trust yet. You're working on it, right? That means that you'll have to risk vulnerability in order to see the power that God intends. It means that you'll have to risk it and be aware the other person is risking it too. It's kind of an intricate dance.
Yeah, let me interject something in there.
Sure.
You know, we talked about how from sexual experiences before we got married or whatever they might be, some people are tremendously scarred. And so you come into this relationship, and what God is saying is, okay, now you have to be completely and entirely vulnerable with this person that you call your husband or your wife now. But you've got all of this baggage from the past that makes you want to not trust. And, you know, you can carry that through your whole marriage, and your spouse might not even know why or what's going on, why you're not trusting, but they'll sense that you're not trusting. And without this level of vulnerability that is supposed to be happening between you two in your hearts and emotionally, you're never gonna get what the Lord really means for you to get out of an intimate union. So, you know, you might have to take stock a little bit. I mean, a lot of tonight is taking stock of attitudes and maybe even some sins from the past, and asking ourselves, how are these things still affecting us now? Okay? As well as, you know, what does the Lord want, and building a vision for what God means for us to have. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. No, that's good. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that too later. And, you know, if you're willing to trust and be trustworthy, you know, if you will reject the secular influences, and what he's talking about, maybe that we've brought some of those secular influences into our marriage from our past. If you're willing to hope for that biblical ideal, it gets better and better. It doesn't even matter that you're getting older. It gets better and better. Intimacy becomes a sign of an invisible reality, a sign of one person to say, I belong entirely and exclusively to you.
So not to beat the dead horse too much, but look, we talked about the idea that sex is a uniting act. It takes two people, it takes two persons and makes them one person. Okay? And if sex is that powerful to connect us with another person deeply, then when it's unaccompanied by self-giving, it is equally powerful to erode and disintegrate our relationships and to prevent us from self-giving. If you had sex outside of marriage, you know, you either had to consciously or unconsciously steel your heart against sex's power to make you one with that person. Okay? You had to learn how to resist it. And again, it could be an unconscious process. Okay? And so what happens is over time, sex begins to lose its covenant-making power for you. So that what could have happened is the day you got married, you found that sex really didn't have that much power to make you one person. I think it's kind of ironic that sex inside a covenant, it works to soften our hearts towards the other person, but sex outside of covenant, it works to harden our heart. And we might have to deal with that. It may be that your sexual past has led to a great deal of hardening or eroded your belief in its power to make you one with your spouse. And you might have to work on that a little bit.
I want to read a passage from Song of Solomon again.
Nope, you're reading 1 Corinthians.
Oh, sorry, I'm reading 1 Corinthians. Okay, 1 Corinthians 7, 3 through 5. My apologies. It says, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer. You know, here at the time when women were considered property to their husband, Paul makes a really radical statement. The husband's body is not his own, but also belongs to his wife, and vice versa. And Paul is making the claim that the male and female partners had the right to mutual sexual relations. Nothing like this had happened before. And it's a remarkably positive view. Roman culture in Paul's time believed that a man was to take his wife just to bear heirs, and that sexual pleasure was sought outside of the marriage. Paul, in effect, redefines marriage as a context of mutual, satisfying eros or passion. And this passage indicates that sex should be regular and reciprocal. The word authority here, literally power or mastery, the wife does not have mastery over her body, and the husband does not have mastery over his. It implies in this that there's a deep spiritual truth here that sex in marriage should be accompanied by a transfer of physical ownership. For sex to have the power the Bible intends, it requires a mutual, unreserved giving of the self physically that is not compelled or coerced, but done gladly. And as we looked at it earlier, the unreserved physical giving of self, when accompanied by an unreserved emotional giving and an acceptance, that's profoundly healing and completing. When you embrace the significance of sex, when you understand its unifying power, when you are willing to be fully vulnerable with the other person, when you are willing to gift yourself physically to another person, then it becomes what God intended.
Yeah, and so let me add something about this idea of gifting yourself to the other person. In that first video we showed how sex has become transactional, right? You get something, you give something to get something, okay? That doesn't fall under this line of what Paul teaches, okay? Sex is not transactional. And, you know, what the Apostle Paul, when he writes this, and what the Lord is telling us through it, is that, look, the ownership rights of each person's physical body have been handed to the other person, okay? And especially in this area of intimacy. So this willingness to give yourself to your spouse, it can really be negatively affected by transactional thinking. You know, you've always kind of seen it like in the, the movies where the husband comes home and the wife's kind of buttering him up with a nice dinner and some romance and all that. And he says, well, what do you want? Right? You know, maybe the perfect example of that is Esther in the Bible, right? You must cleanse yourself. You must get rid of anything that's considered transactional thinking. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about stereotypes and what I would call the psychologizing of sex. There's a general characterization of men being the amorous ones and women not being amorous enough. The psychologizing that our culture does regarding men being visually aroused and men being relationship aroused, and they kind of quantify that. I mean, I think most people have kind of run into that, okay? They'll say something like, you know, men are very visually oriented and they can be visually aroused very easily. And they say, you know, women are relationship oriented. And so, those things may be true. But what I find interesting is you don't see any of that in the Bible, okay? So all the different models that we see from psychologists about sexuality and human sexuality, okay, None of that is in the Bible. Okay, what Paul says is that it's a deeply unifying act that creates one person out of two, and the result, and for it to operate in it powerfully like it should, it must be done in covenant, and it must be done in a relationship where a husband and a wife are willing to give up their physical rights to the other person, willingly and gladly. Okay, so all this stuff about, you know, women give intimacy to get relationship and men give relationship to get intimacy and all that kind of stuff, what it does is it sets us at odds with one another. It puts us in a spot where we're doing what I would call acceptable manipulation, things that society has kind of bought into, but that is not healthy. Sorry, I went off my notes. I guess, you know, what I would say is I think that the Lord wants us to blow apart these characterizations and create a dynamic in our relationship that is totally different. The other thing I want to talk about is performance-based sex. Our sexual society, it is our highly sexualized society, is highly performance-based. I talked about earlier about, you know, trying your lover on for size, so to speak, because you want to see if you're compatible in bed before you get married, okay? If you approach your lovemaking as performance-based, it really means that you're missing what God intended. Because sex is not a matter of technique. It's not a matter of experience. It is a matter of unashamedly and unreservedly giving your entire self to the other person and them reciprocating. So the focus of each partner is giving pleasure, not getting pleasure. And, you know, as I read some of the different research I did on this, one of the interesting quotes from a couple that was being interviewed, they said, "When we stopped trying to perform and just started to simply love one another in sex, things started to move. We stopped worrying about performance and started to ask, how can we just give something to the other?"
I don't know if you guys remember I quoted from an article that a woman wrote later in life where she was looking back on her life. I think that was the first session. It was a room full of yearning and regret. And it was about her looking back, and she had been married and had children, but then she started having affairs for the excitement and all of these things, and she ended up at the end of her life alone. And in her article, as she was reminiscing, she said that her past family, they were broken apart because of her sexual infidelity. And she writes this: "Sex outside of marriage is accompanied by a desire to impress or entice the other person, something like the thrill of the hunt. It injects risk, uncertainty, and pleasure into sex that quickens the heartbeat and stirs the emotions. However, the thrill of the hunt is not the only kind of thrill or passion available, and it is, in fact, not the best."
Yeah. So now that we understand the power of sex and what God intends as far as two people becoming one, I'm going to talk briefly, and we're close to closing here, but I want to talk a little bit about lust, eroticism, and pornography. So our society is highly saturated with sexuality, and there's a lot of these in our daily life. And as a matter of fact, our daily media diet, you get this stuff constantly. Mm-hmm. It has become such a prevalent part of our culture that I think in many ways we as Christians don't even realize the effects that it has on us. And we have adopted secular views. In the church, one area that I have heard, and today you read the psychologists and sociologists agreeing with it, they make a case for the benefits of pornography from society. And, you know, they'll say things that it, you know, spices up your marriage, and, you know, it goes on and on. If you do some research on it, it's amazing the things that the psychologists and sociologists will claim in this area. So there are Christians, and you know, I don't want to be overly harsh here, because there may be some people here who are thinking this way right now, and I want to challenge you on this. Okay, I don't want to condemn you. But if you're using pornography to spice up your marriage life, you know, I understand that there's adrenaline rush that accompanies these things. There's excitement that comes with this. But if we go back and we look at the biblical context, what is it? The biblical context is sex combined with vulnerability and commitment makes something that is powerfully healing. Okay. Pornography doesn't relate to any of those things. Right? Remember the tagline for the night: "The one who caresses my body is also the one who caresses and accepts me entirely." Pornography doesn't enter into that way. See, sex without vulnerability and commitment makes something that's powerful, but powerfully destroying. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand this. It's clear that the media sexuality is entirely impersonal. There's no acceptance. There's no integrative act at all.
You know, there's nothing helpful about pornography. And Greg mentioned, if you're using it to spice up your marriage, you're robbing yourself of what God intended. Even soft porn, Sports Illustrated, I was in Barnes & Nobles, and I walked by, and I'm like, how can that be a bathing suit issue when she's not even wearing a bathing suit? I mean, there was nothing on that woman. That's soft porn or hard porn. They're all based on fantasy and not reality. We did a marriage conference in Pennsylvania, and I was surprised at, I spoke with a lot of the women one-on-one afterwards, and I was surprised at how many of them were using pornography within their marriage to get them in the mood or spice up their love life. Yep. And it was robbing them of what God really intended for them.
Now, let me steal this next line from you, because I taught this at a men's a while back, and I'm going to make a very strong statement. The sexualized media and pornography, they're playing you like a chump. Okay, in the bottom line, they're playing you like a chump, because the person in that picture that is trying to arouse you, they're offering you a fantasy view of love, sexuality, availability. They're offering a promise that they have no intention of ever fulfilling at all, and no ability. So when you allow those images to really get into your mind to manipulate you, you're being played. And so, you know, I make the strong statement because I want to see people free from this. This goes for lust and eroticism also. We looked at the Song of Solomon and Proverbs, and there are a lot of other scriptures. It is clear that the Bible clearly celebrates passion and arousal. Okay, they are clearly part of becoming one flesh. Okay, the point is that because passion and arousal are part of becoming one flesh with your spouse, any type of eroticism that is not oriented towards you and your spouse becoming one flesh, I mean, where do you go with that? Mm-hmm. See, when you begin, you know, God intended for us to look on our wives and wives look on their husbands and to be aroused and to be passionate. And ultimately that leads to this physical union where two persons become one person. And as you've been married, this recommitment of your covenant to one another. So the ultimate end of passion and arousal and those kind of things ultimately is union with your spouse. So what happens is when you engage in arousal in some track that doesn't lead to your spouse, what do you do with that? I mean, there's nothing you can do with it. And ultimately, all you can really do is kind of stuff it in and internalize it, and then it just begins to kind of eat away. Mm-hmm. I say this because I want, you know, I think that this really helped me, because when I really studied through this and I realized that the media was kind of playing me like a chump, I hate to be a chump. And so when those images come up, you can't avoid them. You know, for me, it's a great litmus test. Greg, what would you like to be at this moment? Okay. The role of beauty. If we believe in the two becoming one, then the role beauty plays in our life, I think it will change. Okay. Secular culture is largely constrains beauty to desire. Beauty is leveraged to make us to yearn for fulfillment. You know, if I could just have that person, I could be happy. You see a picture of a woman on a Cosmo magazine in Publix or whatever, pictures on the internet, and though, like I said, those things they're a lie. They're meant to sell us beauty in the entire wrong context. They promise fulfillment without connection, which according to the Bible is impossible. But then they misuse the standard of beauty. 1 Peter 3:3, I hear this read a lot to women. But men, I think that this is more, it says as important for us to understand this as our wives.
31:30.
1 Peter 3:3.
What? Sorry. Oh, you're reading it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're in the wrong
First
spot.
1 Peter 3:3, please. My bad.
Do not let your adornment be merely outward arranging of the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Look, the biblical definition of beauty has nothing to do with the way a woman looks. It has everything to do with her character. And, you know, I mean, men, we have to remember that. We have to teach that to our sons. Because, you know, in many ways, men are kind of driven insane by the... You know, the way the media portrays beauty. And, you know, the thing about beauty that we always have to remember is you have to put in context. So Proverbs 31:30 says, charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Look, you know, when you're 20, you look pretty good, okay? But over time, right, you begin to not look as good as you did when you were 20. Not Janelle. Like Rachel. So, but you know, I mean, let's face it, our beauty deserts us. And at the end of our lives, we're left with our character, aren't we? You know? And so when we see that you know, a woman's beauty is based on her heart and her spirit, I mean, that's really a deep, deep truth. Did I forget to do the thing?
Well, there's a video.
Oh, is that where we're at now? Okay, video, go. Oh, yeah. Well. Well, hold on a minute. Can you pause it?
I don't know.
Hit escape. There you go.
There you go.
Yeah, you're in the wrong spot.
I'm going with your button, babe.
Yeah. Well, let's intro the next spot in here a little bit.
Okay,
before
but we're
we do
running
that.
Out of time.
We're running out of time, so sorry. So that's beauty, okay? If you have any questions, we can talk some more about it.
Well, I talk more about it. That's why I'm kind of pushing
right.
along so we can get
So the last thing we want to talk about is the changes that happen in time and time marches on, okay? Now show the video.
Is that the right place? The right video?
Yeah, that's the right video.
I don't remember his naked.
Thought this would go nicely with the beard and hair. Gee. Well, I hope this isn't our last supper.
Dry, hot weather will continue.
Until September 22nd, midday. And if the Ark isn't finished by then, you will be.
Is that when it's going to happen? September 22nd, midday?
High temperatures tomorrow back into the 90s everywhere right on through Tuesday. And the next 7 days, no showers, no storms, temperatures in the 90s.
That would be a good day to have chicken. Have a mock chicken, huh? Hon, could we have some more chicken September 22nd, midday?
Above average temperatures...
Boys, will you excuse us, please? Your father and I need to have a little talk.
Dad, you busted.
Yeah, I know.
What are you doing?
Do we have anything unleavened?
Yeah, we do. It's in the back next to the frankincense and myrrh. We have a fancy name for it in this century. It's called pita.
Got it.
Evan, what is happening to you? Don't, no. Just put it down. Look at you. The hair, are you on something? Is it a mega growth hormone? What? Evan, talk to me.
I'm building an ark.
What does that mean?
God appeared to me and told me to build an ark. He said there was going to be a flood and that I should be prepared. Whenever I shave, my beard grows right back out. My hair, grows longer every day. This robe, God sent me the robe. Thought it would be funny. I actually think it's really comfortable. That's why I'm wearing it.
The beard, the robe. You're Noah?
Yeah, kind of.
Mom?
Not now, Noah! Dylan?
Hey?
We left everything behind to come here. Maybe that's put too much pressure on you. I don't know. But this has got to stop. Please, you're scaring me. The boys need their father back, and I need my husband back.
Well, this clip.
So what are we going to teach about that?
Yeah. I love that clip because I do think it supports a fundamental rule of marriage. As time marches on, you don't marry one person, but you marry many people. Hopefully you're not marrying someone, you've not married someone who's turning into Noah and going to go in your backyard and build an ark one day. But
things change. My hair on my head and it grows in my ears now.
Definitely one of the things that change is how we look. And our culture isn't very nice about that, as Greg was kind of touching on, especially for women. You know, there is so much screaming at us about our image and how we're supposed to look. They don't think getting wrinkly and losing your tone, and they want you to be thin and all this. You know, it's constantly screaming at us, you know. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we're going to get spare tires. We're going to have that pregnancy weight that just never goes away. Wrinkles do happen. These things, though, oh, and gravity, of course. We don't want to forget about gravity. And there's nothing you can do about it. If you're building your sex life on the foundation of mutual physical attraction, there will be a point where that attractiveness ain't so attractive by the world standards, though. Other physical aspects that could interfere with our intimacy, besides just our looks, is our health. You know, you might be physically hurting or ill, and that can really affect things in your sex life. And, you know, and that's a time where there needs to be seasons of grace. And then when you are feeling good, lots of time in the bedroom. There's also circumstances where your wife or husband, your spouse, may have just lost a job or gone through a trauma, or where you maybe just had your first child and you're tired. You know, there's just physical changes, things that happen, and we have to adjust with grace. I want to touch just real quickly on ghosts from the past. And Greg talked about this. I relabel this the guilt trip. Sex, if you had sex before marriage with other people, or you had sex before marriage as a couple with the person you're married to now, you can bring a lot of baggage of guilt into your marriage. And before I talk about that, I just want to be very, very clear. If you repented of that, if you asked God to forgive you before you stood at the altar, when God looked at you on that altar, you were white as snow. Okay? You were a virgin in God's eyes again. And he looked upon you as clean slate. And so there shouldn't be that guilt brought into the marriage from that. You have to take hold of that forgiveness. If you haven't taken hold of that and you're bringing in a past, you may have some preconceived ideas about how sex should be. You're going to struggle sometimes with comparisons, with visions in your head, different things. And then if you had sex with somebody else before you were married, with old girlfriends of the past, if you and your spouse had sex before you were married, you may be bringing in blame. You know, things go bad, you have a rough spell in your marriage, you might look back and say, well, if you just had self-control, if you had, you know, thought of me better before we got married and you know, didn't lose self-control, you can bring that into the marriage and have guilt and have condemnation. When Greg and I talked about the healing power godly sexual intimacy can have in a marriage, these are areas where it can be more true. If you have those things in your marriage, God can heal them. God can erase the visions. God can erase the comparisons. Because if you're entering into this godly union and being totally vulnerable and being accepted totally, that is healing. And it can heal all of that in the past. So you don't have to have that guilt.
And so that we titled that Ghost of the Past, Ghost in the Present is how we're going to, Ghost in the Present how is how we're going to end. You know, if you're having difficulties in the bedroom right now, it's probably an unresolved issue in your marriage rather than sexual incompatibility. We talked about that because sex is powerful, it is also very sensitive. And you're not going to be able to sweep problems under the rug. Okay, because it is a sign and a seal of our oneness with each other, you know, though you may have some guilt and fear about the past that you have to go through, but there may be growing disrespect or mistrust, unresolved types of things like that in your marriage going on right now. And your intimate life is so powerful and so sensitive that those things are going to affect that area. See, struggles with intimacy with your spouse can be a sign of a deeper problem in the relationship. So these are just a few things that we wanted to talk about tonight as far as intimacy between a husband and a wife. In order to have a healthy love life, it's going to require a lot of hard work, a lot of communication, a lot of commitment to adopt the changing of our spouses over time and all these other things. I want to encourage you to spend some time really thinking, look, pull these scriptures back up, begin to think about the power that God really has inherently put in intimacy between a husband and a wife. Think about the fact that the Bible unashamedly celebrates intimacy between a husband and a wife. Think about the fact that we have all been inundated by a secular culture and it may have influenced us in ways that we just aren't even aware of. Think about the fact that for this to work, the one who caresses me physically must be the one who caresses my whole person. You can't reject certain areas of your spouse or have disrespect for your spouse and not have it affect your intimacy. Because there has to be a complete acceptance in every way. But when you can do those things, then what you will find is that your intimacy gets better and better and better. You'll fall more in love day by day by day. And you'll begin to see the Lord heal you in areas where you may need healing. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for tonight, and I thank you for this this group of people. And, you know, we hope that you would transform our intimate lives. Lord, I pray for those who may really be struggling in this area. You know, maybe they have ghosts from the past that are giving them trouble, or maybe they have beliefs about intimacy being more transactional than just the total, unreserved, unselfish giving of themselves. Maybe, Lord, they didn't realize that there's a powerful role to unite a husband and a wife that can be accomplished no other way. And so, Lord, as the ghosts from the past may have prevented them from really uniting entirely the way that you would want them to. Help us, Lord. Help us to have the courage and the strength to confront the things in our hearts and our minds that that rob us of the power of this area. Lord, help us to repent of our sin in this area. Help us, Lord, to let go of our pride and our desire to not be vulnerable, and to just lay it all out there for our spouses, Lord. So I pray your blessing upon this group tonight. I ask, Lord, that you would fill them with your Spirit, and that, Lord, your hand be upon them, that you'd give them success at everything they put their hand to, that you'd strengthen their families, and that you'd strengthen their marriages, Lord. In Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. You made it.
You made it. So that wasn't too bad, was it?